This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
AI is making waves in every field it touches. President Biden is now on TikTok, and the election draws closer each day. With so much going on in the world, it is hard to keep up with it all, let me tell you. Hi, I'm Kai Ryssdal, the co-host of Make Me Smart. It's a podcast from Marketplace. And every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I break down the latest in business and the economy with short daily episodes to make it easy for you to stay in the know. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello and welcome to Little Gold Men, the award season podcast from Vanity Fair.
It's such an honor to present this next award.
And here are the nominees.
And the Oscar goes to...
And the Oscar goes to...
And I can't deny the fact that you like me right now. You like me.
I'm the king of the world.
There's a mistake. Moonlight, you guys won Best Picture.
I'm Katie Rich, the deputy editor of VanityFair.com, and I'm here with our senior writer, Joanna Robinson.
Hi, Katie.
Our chief critic, Richard Lawson.
Hello.
And sitting in Mike Hogan's seat, Mike is gone once again, but we brought with us a guest. We have David Sims.
Hello. This is more of a throne than a seat.
Right? That's true.
As Mike demands.
It's in Mike's contract.
Right.
David, we brought you on both because you're our friend and you talk about movies with us all the time anyway. Yeah. And this is the week of the release of Tim Burton's Dumbo. And at this point, thanks to the Blank Check miniseries, I think you're the world expert on Tim Burton. Is that the title you've given yourself? I certainly
had to watch all 19 Tim Burton films.
Blank Check, for those who don't know, and shame on you, is a podcast that David, who is a film critic at The Atlantic, does with Griffin Newman, an actor, where they discuss directors' filmographies. So basically each season, quote unquote, is structured around one director. Career.
Yeah.
And you're currently doing the big daddy of them all, Tim Burton.
It's a slog because the arc of Tim Burton's career is up and then down, basically,
and then down,
quality-wise.
And then
not,
down.
Yeah, and then down and down.
And then there's an elephant.
And then there's an elephant.
Yeah, an elephant who goes up, up, up into the sky. So we'll talk about Dumbo later in the show, but we want to do just some general news catch-up first. We're going to hit some of the Oscar-y trailers that have debuted in recent weeks to figure out what they might have in store. But first, at least I, and I know Joanna because she was in the room, spent a good chunk of yesterday watching Apple try to convince us that they are the future of Hollywood. It's mostly about television, their bid, at least so far. But Joanna, since you were in the room, what did you learn at what you kind of described as the Church of Apple?
It was a fascinating thing to watch. I was there with like a bunch of other TV journalists where, you know, we've all been together at TCA. We've seen this kind of thing before, the Television Critics Association press tour. But Apple's like, okay, but what if we did it our way and made you sit through this pitch about a credit card first? And that's fine. Like, whatever. But
so much applause for a credit card. It was really surreal.
Yeah. But like, it was fascinating and weird to be on that campus to see all that Apple culture sort of try to meet the Hollywood culture. And what was interesting, and everyone watching at home realizes too, is like they didn't really have a lot to actually show us. And so they trotted out their stars, but they had just a really brief sizzle reel of the actual TV that they're going to be showing. They didn't have actually even a lot of detail about what their platform will be. They had some information, but not really relevant information like, oh, I don't know, pricing and stuff like that. So, you know, Apple getting into the streaming platform, aggressively into the streaming platform business, Apple trying to make the argument that they will have original program that will rival Netflix and make their platform, you know, a can't miss. I don't know that I walked away convinced. I did walk away excited that they had Oprah, but I don't think you can be in the same room as Oprah and not walk away excited, right? So like Oprah was there and I was like, oh my God, this is great. And then as soon as she walks on stage, you're like, what did I actually just see? So yeah. And then I think one thing worth mentioning, and I know David had a great write-up on The Atlantic about this as well, but like, I think one thing worth mentioning overall is how this flavors the earlier conversation we were having about Spielberg and Netflix. Because it's not as if it's a secret that Spielberg was doing work for Apple TV. Like, this has been announced, like, 2 years ago. Like, it's been in the trays and stuff like that. But I think seeing him up there, because he was there on the Apple campus for the first time, as he said, on stage, and he was the main part of this big sort of glossy black and white trailer that they played of just, like, talking heads talking about what film is or something. That Spielberg is so closely associated with this streaming platform makes the fact that he was going, I don't know, so hard, or however you want to put it, against Netflix with the Academy in this recent conversation we were having, it just casts it in a slightly different light, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. The whole thing was fascinating, but also I think kind of a debacle in some ways. Like, don't do this until you have stuff to actually show us, until you actually have pricing, like you said, Joanna. And also, like, I mean, I made this joke at the same time on Twitter that Jim Poniewozik from The Times did. Right. It was like, Apple, this is just an upfront.
This is just upfront.
And it's upfronts, for those who don't
plus
know.
Plus a credit
like,
card yeah, upfronts well, as right. well. Right,
yeah. Where, like, basically you just, like, this is the new season, and it's just the thing for advertisers to kind of... But, like, you know, having these big stars come out and talk, it was like, okay, but, like, the patter was really kind of trite and boring, the Incredible. Way they described the shows. It just was like, this is your new sexy revolutionary thing. This is something we've seen so many times before. And the shows all sounded familiar.
They do. They have big stars.
Yeah. Like, bigger than normal.
Yeah. You know, that's about it, right?
Something they're doing, I was talking to Libby Hill of Underwire about it afterwards, and she was a little frustrated because she was like, it feels like they're trying to say, we've got all the best talent in the world. We're going to tell all the best stories, but they trotted out all these people we already know, you know, and so they're saying, like, all the best stories kind of have already been told or something like that. My understanding of what I saw is that they're, you know, they've got marquee talent at the top of things, but that's really an umbrella over some other talent. So I am curious to see some of the things like Kumail Nanjiani and Emily Gordon's show, Little America, like what Kumail said on stage. And I will say Kumail's the only one who actually delivered his patter well.
He
so.
Has to be the only one who wrote his own patter, right? Like, he sounded like a human.
Right.
And no one else did.
Everyone else is like, the power of a story.
Yeah.
It tells a story, you know.
But kudos to the stand-up comedian for actually being able to stand up there and be funny. But, like, he was talking about this project, and he said, you know, all of the people who wrote and directed these episodes are either immigrants or children of immigrants. This is a story. It's an anthology story, true stories of immigrants in America. And so, like, you're putting Kumail and Emily at the top of this because they're people a lot of us recognize. And then you've got other interesting talent underneath. Or, like, what Sarah Bareilles is doing with Little Voice, maybe, which is a show about, like, New York musicians. Maybe that will be interesting. Like, maybe. But Oprah is certainly nothing new. And as Katie pointed out, while they were doing this big glossy trailer to be like, we've got someone, you've been missing her, here she is, she's back, she's been away from TV. And Katie's like, did she add her own network? Like, what are you talking about? Oprah hasn't quite
Sorry,
been gone for
own.
TV. Like if they said, we're going to have Oprah do the Oprah Winfrey Show every day again. That's one thing. But Oprah's just doing docuseries for them. And I'm like, no, not to knock that. That's great. I'm excited. But, like, that's not a new thing. So I don't know if it's just Apple doesn't understand. But what's true, when they show their products, you know, when they're like, okay, here's our new Apple Arcade, which is a gaming system, they had a lot of information about that. You need that information to show me this other thing. You can't just dazzle me with Reese Witherspoon, though she looked lovely. You know, like, it was just indicative of a tech industry not really knowing what is done here. And it's okay to not do what is done, but then you need to do something better than what they did, I guess.
It also
is my point.
Makes me concerned about quality of the shows.
Sure.
I mean, the very, very, you know, small amount of footage that we saw looked good.
Yeah.
Looked expensive. I mean, Jason Momoa and Alfre Woodard in some sort of way, way, way post-apocalyptic thing
yeah,
where everyone's blind.
Yeah, it's Cloud Atlas, but they're blind.
It's Cloud Atlas, but they're blind.
Or Bird Box.
Bird Box.
Bird
Box.
Box.
Yeah, Bird Cloud yeah. Atlas Box.
But it's like, okay. Like, I don't know. I found the whole thing to be so underwhelming.
It all looked a little Mad Libby, like this yeah. sort of, it's a morning show, and Steve Carell is here, you know. And then, like, Haley Steinfeld's Emily Dickinson, but it's going to be, like, modern.
Right.
Brooklyn
yeah.
Prince is going to be, like, Harriet the Spy, but...
Right.
You know, not I mean, Harriet the Spot.
Don't
right,
knock
you know.
Brooklyn Prince.
No,
that
I love
amazing.
Brooklyn Prince. There's a lot of Brooklyn Prince in that sizzle reel. Yeah. The sizzle reel was like 30% Brooklyn Prince. My take on it, which I did write about at The Atlantic, was that they seem to be trying to be HBO, you know, rather than the Netflix thing of like, we've got so much. It's more like we have stars and we have prestige and this is going to be like, you know, a quality product worth your unspecified amount of money that we'll let you know later once we figure out how much we think people want to pay for this.
Right, right.
I mean, it's not just when we figure out what we think people are going to pay for it. Like, basically, Silicon Valley has been trying, you know, at Verizon, at Intel, have all been trying to do this. We can give you just the slim cable that you want, just the cable that you want, the live sports that you want, you know, the FX that you want, the whatever that you want without having to do the massive cable package. But there's like no way to actually do that and keep the price point any different than, you know, they've tried. When you negotiate, once you like say, okay, we can give you HBO, we can give you this, we can give you that, then your price point is as high as a cable deal is. And so like that's the thing that Apple, that's why Apple has not said how much this is going to cost, because I guarantee you it's going to cost a lot. And so, you know, and so they're banking on the fact that their programming is going to be must have, can't miss. But I just got to say that like the fact that their competition is HBO, which you can get for $10 a month, or is Netflix, which you can get for, I don't know how much Netflix costs right now. How much is a pint of milk even? I don't know. But like, it is not something that I have a lot of faith in.
Well, so. The other thing is all these services that are its rival did not launch on the back of 10 TV shows. Like, people didn't subscribe to Netflix because of House of Cards. You know, they were already subscribers.
Right.
Because yeah. It was a DVD rental service, and then it was a big streaming library.
And you got HBO because they had,
HBO,
like, movie releases.
HBO because you had cable, and it has movies. Like, you know, and then yeah. They started adding in original shows. Amazon, you got an Amazon Prime because you wanted free
a
delivery.
A drone to deliver deodorant to your
right.
house.
Right. Yeah. Apple, it's, you know, they didn't say the price, but they did say this will be, you know, an ad-free subscription service. Apple's saying, like, pay us some money for these shows.
For
like,
these,
literally
for these
shows.
Particular shows.
Exactly.
Well, do you guys see value in what they're promising, that, like, they can have everything in one place, that you can, like, subscribe to CBS All Access
they
and Showtime?
They already have that.
Like,
that's called
thing.
Cable television.
Yeah,
I mean,
Amazon has that, and Apple has that. Apple's version is bad. Like, on my Amazon TV, you can subscribe to, like, CBS All Access, like, through it.
Right.
And then it all gets sort of, like, put on a landing page for you, which is fine. It's cable TV. Like, you know, it's sort of like a slightly easier to navigate version, right? And that's what the Apple thing is.
Yeah, what Apple was promising was you wouldn't have to toggle between apps
right.
in their thing anymore. And I was like, it's not, but except if you want to go to Netflix, because they don't own Netflix, right?
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Like,
or Disney Plus in 6
yeah,
months.
But like toggling between apps is not that hard. It is kind of annoying sometimes when you're trying, maybe if you don't write about TV for a living, if you're trying to remember, wait,
which
app
one's
has,
on which channel?
Yeah, and like, is there a new episode of X this week?
Yeah.
And, you know,
but wait,
whatever.
With the Netflix thing, does that mean, so I have like an older Apple TV.
Yeah.
And it has like a Netflix button or whatever.
Yeah.
Is that not going to be on Apple TV anymore?
No, it will. It's just it won't be like integrated into their like landing page.
It won't
page.
Be in the
You'll
TV
just have to go
app.
To Netflix.
But like the Hulu button, if it were, or like the HBO Go button will all be under one app. It's just Netflix will be the only one pretty much that will be outside
okay,
of it.
Everything will be in one main feed except
right.
for Netflix.
Right.
Yeah.
So if I want to watch season one of Gypsy again, I'll have to go.
The other thing I was going to say, you know, to David's point is like it reminds me a lot of Marvel Studios versus what Warner Brothers tried to do with Justice League, where Marvel Studios is like, here's Iron Man, here's Captain America, here's Thor. Okay, do you want to see them all together? Cool, let's go. Warner Brothers is like, we've got the Justice League right off the bat. You love it. Here it goes. A lot of content. And they're like, whoops, nope, we did not lay track for this. I'm so sorry. And so, like, it's the lack of laying track. But like, as David pointed out, like, when you started Netflix, you had, like, two original shows but a lot of other things to offer. And so for them to come out of the gate spending so much money on all this original programming, I'm worried that people are just going to be like, okay, I liked that morning show, but I don't know. Actually, I'm here for the Emily Dickinson, the anachronistic yeah. Emily Dickinson show for some reason.
Yeah.
I'm here for that. But, like, I'm here for one thing. And then it's so funny because that's the argument they were making about this new magazine service that they were promoting, which is like, we know you only really want to read one magazine article so out of this thing. So why pay for the whole magazine? You know, like, they're presenting two different arguments in the same presentation and really just trying to sell you on Apple itself. And I'm like, I like a lot of what you do. I have a lot of your products, but I don't know that I trust you. I have any reason to trust you to be my TV people.
Yeah. I was, and maybe this was like a metaphor or something, but I was at the supermarket the other day, and ahead of us in line was a woman who had like two big bags full of groceries, and she was trying to pay using Apple Pay, and it wasn't working.
Sure.
It wasn't reading her thing, and she was like, "But I she clearly had left the house with no other means of paying for anything because." And I'm just, it was just like, I don't know that I trust Apple or really any big company like that to sort of so bind together everything in a way that you're sort of reliant on them and on only them. But again, I've been doing that with cable for years,
right.
So like it, mm-hmm. but then that's why the option of having a Netflix thing or an Amazon thing separate felt sort of revolutionary. But now it's going the other direction where I'm just like, but now
it's all getting bundled again, basically.
Yeah. So I don't know. I also think that those Apple events, whatever their product they're announcing, are always so cult-like and creepy. And I think of Dave Eggers' book, The Circle. And,
right.
Freak out.
Those black and white photos of the stars as they like stood on stage like in front of like giant shadowy portraits of themselves was really wild.
I think the creepiest of all for me was, and I wrote about this in my piece, is like we were upstairs, so we heard them downstairs rehearsing and clapping. And so when you get into the room, it's like really clear who was there for rehearsal in terms of like how loudly they're clapping and when they're clapping. And like, that's fine. Upfronts has that too. TCA has that too, where they have like their own people in the room. But they were like planted throughout the audience in this really like creepy sort of seated in way that I was just like, this is all... I don't know. It just did not work for me at all.
The Run Through with Vogue is where you'll meet all the most exciting people in fashion and culture.
I am Fran Lebowitz, who should be the mayor of New York.
We all support that. We support that.
Very nice.
Nikki.
Yes.
It's been really great being in this beautiful pink room.
All right, Usher, can you hear us?
I can hear you.
All right.
Can you hear me?
We can.
We can.
All right, here we are.
On the podcast, you'll learn how Vogue really works.
Sometimes we'll come in for a second or even third run through until we are AWOK.
Can you tell us what AWOK means?
It means AWOK, Anna Wintour OK.
I'm Cho Minardi.
And I'm Chloe Mel.
And we're the hosts of The Run Through with Vogue, where fashion and culture collide.
Join us. It's AWOK.
Listen and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
Well, maybe we should talk now about some movies that are not coming from Apple, but will probably be rentable on your Apple TV, iTunes app, whatever we're going to call it, in a year or so. We wanted to talk about just some trailers that have debuted. And we talked about a little bit of this last week in our 2020 Oscar predictions episode, but it's probably a good time to get into detail about how all of these potential Oscar contenders are selling themselves to us, all of them fairly early. I think the first big one that we definitely talked about last week was Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. So that trailer premiered right after we recorded our episode. We were kind of talking about posters and the photos of Leonardo DiCaprio and kind of like a Hairspray-esque set. And the trailer came out with basically a lot of that. This movie's coming out the end of July. It's from Quentin Tarantino. It's obviously got like a ton of recognition around it. Do we feel like the trailer sold us any more on or any differently on what Quentin Tarantino is trying to do with this Charles Manson story?
I mean, I don't really know what the movie's about based on that sort of sizzle reel.
Right.
Yeah.
Is it a Charles Manson? I mean, like, I know Charles Manson will be adjacent, but like, is
the
it
going to
be about
him? Playing
him
is not like a terribly famous actor. He was Unjustified, done some other TV stuff, so I don't know what that means. There's a weird joke right at the top of the trailer that I'm like, are they boyfriends, Brad Pitt and Leonardo DiCaprio?
Oh, the carrying his load thing?
Yeah, and I was like, what? That's a weird thing to lead with, you know, if it's... And then Margot Robbie's doing dancing around Sharon Tate.
Leo's dancing. Plenty of dancing.
It looks I mean, I know it's about Charles Manson, so clearly violence is on its way, but it looks like it's not about people shooting each other necessarily, unlike a lot of Quentin Tarantino movies. So I don't know. I'm intrigued, but I'm also a little tired.
Yeah.
That sounds like a lot of Quentin Tarantino movies when they come down the pike. You're like, whew, okay, can I handle this?
You know, Quentin Tarantino movies usually, the trailers usually really lead with premise, like Kill Bill. Like, you know, it's very like, here's what's happening, here's what she's trying to do. The Hateful Eight was also, you know, it's like, we put all these guys in a room and they're gonna face off. And this trailer is like, 60s Hollywood, and we have movie stars. That's it. There's no real plot talk. I mean, we know it's about a movie star and a stuntman, I guess.
Right.
No, not even a movie. He's like an actor. He's not a movie star. He's like a...
I think he's on like a Gunsmoke like kind of
right,
show.
Yeah. Right, exactly.
But what's kind of Sorry, go ahead.
No, you go ahead. I mean, and then Margot Robbie, who they're not saying she's playing Sharon Tate, but we've read, right. That, like, is sort of just, like, doing some go-go dancing, like, isolated from them. We don't see them interacting. We don't see anything.
Yeah.
Which is fine. Yeah. I mean, it's a teaser, I guess.
What's a big question mark about it is if it is about the Manson murders, like, Sharon Tate was quite pregnant when the Manson murders happened, like
true.
eight months. And Margot Robbie is distinctly not, at least in the footage that's in the trailers. There's some like talk that maybe she will be at some point in the movie. So like there's a couple possibilities that came out of this trailer. One is that it takes place over a long period of time, you know, like a couple years at least.
Well, yeah, because right? Leo looks pretty worn down at the end. That where he's got the long hair and the beard.
Yeah.
And,
right.
Yeah. So, like, you know, the rise and fall of someone's career or something like that with the Manson murder sort of backgrounded. The question of the optics of, like, can one background the Manson murders? Can one background the death of this famous woman? She, like, I think Alana Bennett had a really good tweet about, you know, this is a story about the murder of a woman executed mostly by women, and this is a story about two men. Like,
I don't think it is a story about Sharon Tate. I think that's
I think it's her sister who has been like, understandably hackles Rig, Sharon Tate's real sister, has her hackles up about like all the Manson projects that are coming out this year. Reportedly met with Tarantino, saw what he was doing and was like, okay, this one I'm not worried about.
Sure.
So there's the whatever Mary that Heron means,
movie, right? There's like a Manson movie coming out this month.
Yeah.
Right,
Charlie Says with Matt Smith. Right.
Right. Right.
And then and, The Haunting of Sharon Tate or something.
And The Haunting of Sharon Tate, which is a real, real bad thing. The other possibility is that maybe this is some sort of alternate history, a la Inglourious Basterds.
Right.
Some people are like wondering, does Sharon Tate kill Charles Manson in this one or something like that? Like, who knows? I don't know. And then the other thing that a lot of people seem to be talking about, at least on my Twitter feed, was this depiction of Bruce Lee in the film, because like from 2 seconds of footage, it looked like Brad Pitt's character was getting a leg up over Bruce Lee in a fight, and people were really ticked about that. I think that is, it's way too early to judge what the depiction of Bruce Lee will be in this film, but what's true and what's fun, my friend, and I don't know, maybe yours if you're listening, Lindsay Romain over at Nerdist, did a fun breakdown of the trailer of like all the real people who are in the trailer, like Mama Cass is in the trailer. So there's like some fun, like cool real life stuff. If you're up on the period and want to like go frame by frame in that trailer, that's kind of fun. But I think you guys are all right in that, unlike a lot of other Tarantino projects, we have no idea really what this is about. And that's par for the course with a lot of large projects in Hollywood these days, that they like don't want you to know very much before you see it. But I think with a lot of Tarantino stuff, since it can push the boundaries of things, I think that people has people bracing for impact rather than excited and curious, if that makes sense.
Well, with the Bruce Lee thing, I mean, Quentin Tarantino's always been great on race stuff, so
Lindsay Romain, who shout out Lindsay, did point out Bruce Lee would train stuntmen, and that looks like that's what's happening in that scene,
right?
He was
that he like taught Sharon Tate how to fight.
He would teach
like,
you the moves. That was part of his sort of Hollywood career.
That was his come up.
I sort of knew that, but like Lindsay was the one who pointed that out. But No, I mean, you know, Quentin likes to play fast and loose. He likes to get right, like push. But how long has it been? I guess The Hateful Eight was that 2014 or 15? I forget. You know, that I guess it wasn't that long ago.
Yeah, it was like a few years ago, 3 years ago, I think.
That was the first Tarantino movie where I just felt kind of drained and exhausted at the end of it, rather than like, hey, you know, there's nobody like him, you know?
Well, my whole thing with him, and I'm imposing what I want a filmmaker to do on what the filmmaker wants to do, which is not fair, certainly, but like, I think he's still obviously talented, you know, voice of a generation in some ways, but I just want him to say more. You know, and I think Hateful Eight was frustrating because I was like, okay,
sure, right.
We've seen this. This is not about anything. This is nihilistic. It's just like you kind of having a wank and like doing something that should be a stage play, frankly. My hope in the vagueness of this trailer and the idea that it might be about a longer passage of time than normally his films deal with is that there could be some emotional core to it. And I think that's what I've been missing from his movies. There's a glimmer of it in Inglourious Basterds, certainly in Melanie Laurent's character. but like really Beatrix Kiddo crying on the bathroom floor at the end of Kill Bill 2 is the absolute most emotional that he's ever gotten as a filmmaker. And if that's not his ken and he's not interested in that, fine. But like, I would like to see more, certainly more than The Hateful Eight gave us.
And it's also been a while since we've seen, you know, Leo in a film, right?
Right, which is the big selling point.
Yeah. And so, like, you know, exactly what you're mentioning, Richard, like, that final shot, you know, it's played kind of for laughs, obviously, but it's also, like, it feels emotionally authentic in that trailer. So, like, I could see Leo giving us something really, really good in this, obviously. I mean, like, it's Leo. Come on.
Well, Richard, you were saying last week, I think, that the smart money is on this movie premiering at Cannes. So I wonder if we're going to get this kind of very intriguing but vague teaser, and then the most we're going to learn about it is going to be when you guys get to see it at Cannes, and having it filtered through reactions at this festival with all these like international critics. It's a really interesting way to launch a movie that's opening in late July. It's going to be, you know, competing with the second weekend of The Lion King.
Yeah, I think it's pretty much sort of unofficially confirmed that it is going to be at Cannes.
And that's the friendliest audience he could possibly.
It's a very friendly audience, and it's a funny kind of thing. Because, you know, Terry Fermont, who runs the festival, has been kind of in the, really the last 2 years kind of been like, you know what, we've gone too deep on like Hollywood stuff and big movie stars. We need to focus more on international cinema, you know, trying to kind of change this, the proportions of the festival in a weird reaction to how Venice has been kind of turned into this Oscar clearinghouse. But then here we have this like movie called Once Upon a Time in Hollywood with two of the biggest like white male American movie stars ever. So it's like, okay, if that's the only splashy thing, you know, from America that they have at the festival, that's, you could do a lot worse. I mean, that's pretty big and splashy. So, yeah, Katie, I think you're right that like my guess would be it premieres at Cannes and then like the next day they drop a full trailer.
Sure. Right. Sure.
I mean, there's another title I'm curious about for being at festivals just because it dropped a trailer without a release date. Lucy in the Sky, we also talked about a bit last week. It's Natalie Portman as the lady astronaut who made headlines back in 2003 when she got kind of caught up in a love triangle. It's directed by Noah Hawley, who made Fargo. It's coming from Fox Searchlight, but doesn't have a release date. Is that something we should like look for at Cannes maybe? Or is that like we're just going to talk about it all summer and then they'll show up at Toronto?
That screams Toronto to me, that thing.
Yeah.
But I don't know.
Maybe. Well, I think Hawley maybe is too small for it to be at Venice, but
Like Telluride, maybe.
Yeah, Telluride, sure. Right, you know. I mean, it's a really intriguing trailer, and I think that what interests me more than the Hawley aspect, because I like a lot of what he does in terms of the TV series Fargo. I don't like a lot of what he does in terms of the other one that I can't remember the name of.
With Legion.
Legion. Thank you. Natalie Portman has been on this fascinating career trajectory recently between winning an Oscar for Black Swan, where she's like insane in it, and then doing this crazy performance in Jackie that I think she pulls off really well. Yep. Then Vox Lux, where she's done little stuff in between those things, but Vox Lux, where she's playing this like Staten Island pop star, like it's a crazy performance, but I think is so good.
And Annihilation.
Oh, Annihilation. So yeah, Annihilation, a little more muted, but a very interesting, odd movie. So I think she's on this interesting trajectory, and this seems like with her very strange haircut and like the intensity of the story.
She's doing an accent again.
Yeah. So I don't know. I'm intrigued for that alone. I don't know that you know, I don't know really know where the broader industry is on her right now. Like I think people sure like still remain fans, but her work of late has been a little bit alienating for some, and so I think people start to resent that over time. So I'll be curious, but I'm all in.
Right.
Yeah, the fact that she got a nomination for Jackie, which is a movie that like really struggled to find a fans. I liked it a lot too. I guess it says something about her continued power as a, you know, A-list movie star.
Yeah, I mean, she was an Oscar winner playing Jackie Kennedy. I mean, she sort of had money in the bank. But you're right, that movie ended up alienating everyone, even though it rules. But yeah, you're right, Richard, that like there's the Pattinson zone where it's like, Can you just not make one for them? You know what I mean? Right. Where it's like eight for you?
Yeah.
And, you know, and I love like what Robert Pattinson or Kristen Stewart or whoever, you know, these bankable stars just end up are like, I'm going to Eurozone. I'm going to make art films only. Yeah. You know,
Brady Corbett and I are getting on a KLM flight to Amsterdam but see you later.
I mean, I don't think Natalie hasn't made like a blockbuster since like Thor the Dark World, right?
And Annihilation
was
like
so happy to be in.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
Annihilation was an attempt at that maybe, but I think like, you know, given like who directed it and what it was about and how it was about what it was about, like I would, Natalie Portman's a smart person. I'm sure she wasn't like thinking it was going to be a $400 million movie, you know.
The ceiling for Annihilation was like Arrival.
Yeah.
And then Paramount saw it and they were like,
yeah,
sell this thing to Netflix.
Yeah. Yeah.
Two other movies we've gotten looked at recently that Richard and David, you guys being at Sundance, got to see sooner. A24 released a trailer for The Last Black Man in San Francisco, and then Amazon released one for Late Night, the Mindy Kaling, Emma Thompson movie. Let's talk about Last Black Man in San Francisco first, because that's something that, you know, didn't have a ton of stars. It wasn't, like, as much on people's radars from Sundance, but seemed to come out of that festival just, like, really a lot of affection around it.
Yeah, I mean, it stokes that kind of affection. It has this beautiful score. It's beautifully shot. The two central performances, these two young guys who are not terribly known actors.
One of them is total unknown. One of them is sort of like a guy you might recognize, not a well-known guy.
And the lead guy, the director, he and them are childhood
friends.
They're
like friends, pals, and they came up with a story together, I think.
Yeah, so it has this kind of from-the-heart sort of quality to it. Past that, I think it has some issues. I think it's a bit cluttered. I think that, like, they tried to do too much. You know, I've read in interviews that they cited Napoleon Dynamite as an influence, which is never a good thing to read. And it shows a little bit in the film. But, like, I think it's going to find... I mean, David, I don't know if you agree with me, but I think it'll find a passionate fan base.
For sure.
How big that fan base is, I don't know.
I think I like it a little more than you. I do agree that it's quite long and it has this sort of very... sleepy, intentionally kind of gauzy, like, tone where you're sort of like, it's sort of lulling you. Mm-hmm. And then it, you know, builds to this ending that isn't like cataclysmic or crazy. You know, it's a sweet movie with, you know, a lot of like promise, but it has this message of like, we can't live in these cities anymore. Like, it's impossible to even like own a home, let alone like rent a home, like anything like that. In places like San Francisco anymore, and like it's sort of this elegiac, like, you know, goodbye to these, like, and that might find some traction this year. Like, that does feel like something that people will glom onto. When's it coming out?
Is it the summer? June 14th.
Yeah. You know,
which I believe is similar to when Eighth Grade opened last year. Is that what you're gonna say?
But now? Also, Sorry to Bother You and Blindspotting also opened around then last
Bay
year.
Area.
Sorry to Bother
You. Yeah, the Bay Area.
The only
the Bay Area movie. I don't know if this is the right platform to talk about this, but my as a Bay Area resident, my roommate wrote a piece on Medium last year about, like, if San Francisco is so great, why is everyone I know like I love leaving it, which went hugely viral. And my roommate has like no official platform, no whatever. It's basically like a blog post. It went insanely viral because it is such a strong feeling, not just in the Bay Area, but in a lot of cities in America. Where it's just sort of like the people who are born here, who were raised here, can't live here anymore, you know, and we're like, you know, white people, like the talk to the non-white communities in the Bay Area and you hear this message even louder. So I know in the Bay Area, at least, like, watching this trailer, I almost cried thinking about all the friends that I had who had to like leave to move to the middle of the country because they could not afford to live here anymore. So whether or not the movie actually delivers on that, you know, or whether it is sort of just like empty and dreamy and elegiac, like, I don't know. But like, I will tell you, at least the Bay Area, I expect, will be lining up for this movie. If not, you know, like plenty of people around New York who feel like they can't live where they in the neighborhoods they used to be able to live in New York, et cetera, et cetera. Whether or not that will hit with the heartland, I don't know. But maybe it'll be all the people who had to leave the cities will be interested in seeing.
Yeah. It'll be me with my children who I couldn't afford to raise in New York.
Exactly. I mean, it is one of the big civic issues of the era right now, you know, in because people moved back into, well, you know, gentrification happened in the last 20 so years. And it's really great watching a movie deal with that. And I think that we've seen films recently, including Blindspotting, deal with this issue in different ways. And this is a really interesting approach. It's a more poetic, it's a more weary, sort of sad thing. It's not a polemic. It's not, you know, there's anger in it for sure, but it's not a movie that's kind of trying to like boil the blood and get us to you know, foment revolution or anything. It's more just like, well, no. Goodbye, you know.
Yeah, it's elegiac, not like angry.
And that tone, I think
it's passionate.
Yeah. So I think that you know, the emotional sort of core there gives it certainly some heft. And I think, you know, you know, in terms of awards, I don't know if that's it's the kind of movie that really it holds
maybe
up to that sort of
play. You know, that's yeah. eighth grade zone is probably the yeah. ceiling.
Like Spirit Awards?
Sure. Yeah. But yeah, you never know if it'll catch on. The Napoleon Dynamite thing you said is interesting. It does kind of have that vibe.
Quirky. Very quirky.
I was going for quirky. I liked the quirky more than you, I think.
It's also a testament to how a beautiful score can really just lift a movie so much. Emil Mosseri,
it's like his
wrote
first score,
yeah,
basically.
Wrote the score, and it's kind of referencing Dan Romer from Beasts of Southern Wild or some Max Richter here and there. But like, and that's fine. I mean, because plenty of composers reference each other all the time. But without that score, I think that some of the emotional moments don't land as well. But that's okay because that's part of filmmaking, you know.
Sure.
So if it's relying on some of its aesthetics, be it visually or orally, whatever. So many movies do that. So I shouldn't ding it for that.
Something I want to say, you know, I'm going to start calling it like the Bay Area film movement, right? Like you've got Sorry to Bother You, Blindspotting. You've got Ryan Coogler doing some like Oakland stuff in Black Panther. You had Gin, this great movie that came out last year. And this is like, it's all these actual Bay Area filmmakers coming back to make movies about the Bay Area. Like the fact that Jello Biafra's in this movie about San Francisco, you know, punk Bay Area punk legend Jello Biafra, like I don't know. It's really fun to see, and I'll be curious if it keeps growing and growing, and if we're at the beginning of some kind of interesting movement around Bay Area and filmmaking. I know a lot of there are a few filmmaking like production companies and stuff like that that are starting to set up some shop here in the city. So I don't know if you'll just see more and more about it.
Let's talk quickly about Late Night, just because it's another Sundance hit. It has kind of a bigger, obvious draw on Mindy Kaling and Emma Thompson. And it's coming out in early June. And I'm remembering how last summer was really fun for indie movies with Eighth Grade and Hereditary and all these docs making their way through theaters. Late Night seems like great summer counter-programming.
Totally.
Yeah. I mean, I was way up on that movie. I think a lot of other people I talked to were like, you know, that was fun. I thought it was great. And I think that, you know, for our sort of, you know, awards focus purposes, like Emma Thompson is really great in it. It's kind of the juiciest role she's had in a long time.
For sure.
You know, if Streep can get in for Devil Wears Prada, I don't, you know, Thompson's doing a little bit less than Streep was doing in that movie, like in terms of like character work. But
yeah.
But I think it's great. And, you know, it's fun to see Mindy Kaling sort of scale her sensibility up from up from television. I mean, it's like a bigger, you know, sort of glossier kind of thing, and I think that she acquits herself well. I think the movie has some great supporting players, a couple who are maybe weirdly cast.
But it has like you know, Reed Scott as like a jerk. He's great.
Yeah, sure. So John Early is a kind of like gay jerk.
Right. Yeah, he's great. Yes. John Lithgow is a sort of sadder older guy.
Oh God, that's right.
You know?
Yeah.
He's great.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a pleasant movie that actually I do think, though, you know, despite that pleasantness, it is also talking about a current issue that, you know, in terms of diversity in the workplace and how you address that. And I think in a weird way and in a very, I should say, specific and isolated way, it comes up with something of a solution, which is like the way you get these, you know, sort of venerable older people to accept diversity in the place that they sort of rule is to appeal to their vanity, you know, and appeal to their sense of relevance. And you know, that's not a cure-all for the whole system, clearly. But, like, within this little world, this little fiefdom, I think that Kaling is like, here's a possible way to kind
here's
of change
kind of
someone's
how
mind.
It actually works, yeah. Right. Yeah. I'm less high on that movie than you are, but Emma's so good. Emma's just, like, kind of what keeps me. Then everything else is a tad broad.
Sure.
Which is fine, and it's going to be good in the summer. Like, it's going to be, like you say, just a fun, broad comedy to, like, have a good time, like, in the midst of all of the Marvels and the various other big explosion movies that are coming out
this
summer.
I think it's opening the exact same weekend as Ocean's 8 did last year. Is that, like, a decent comparison?
I mean, Ocean's 8, again, kind of, you know, it had, like, the heist. You know, this is a smaller movie. It was, you know, made independently. I don't know how much it cost. You know, and it doesn't have that kind of scale. But it does have, like, you know, a lot of nice New York stuff. And, you know, like, some genuinely fun kind of location stuff like that. And, you know, it's a little glitzy looking. And Emma, Emma's kind of what just rooted me there. She could get an Oscar nomination, like, easy. I don't, like, depend, you know, that... category gets so hot these days, like, that I feel like Best Actress is always the most crowded field, but everyone loves Emma Thompson, and it's been a while, right? It's
been a long time.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Let's talk about one last summer title before we jump onto Dumbo. I just wanted to talk about Rocket Man again. I do feel like we have a weekly Rocket Man segment. Because last week they did this big glitzy thing where they like invited a bunch of LA journalists to a club to watch 25 minutes of footage, and Taron Egerton was there. And I'm just continually astonished at the confidence in this thing, the full court press. Like, obviously they've got Bohemian Rhapsody as an example of just how big something like this can be.
That's where the confidence is coming from. That thing's about to make $1 billion.
Well, but it also has to be good enough, right? Like, if it's, I mean, I guess Bohemian Rhapsody.
No. Has not at all.
Well, David, you haven't been on to talk about this every week. Like, how are you feeling about this movie at this point?
I think it looks pretty good. I like Elton John a lot. Like, I am really in the bag for that movie. I also enjoy Taron Egerton. Like, you know, I find him charming.
Not Richard.
Yeah, no. Maybe I'm not a Richard. If Richard's a 10, I'm a 7.5, right? On Taron. But I like the sort of Fantasia element they seem to be pushing in the trailers, and from what I'm hearing about this footage as well.
You mean the thing with the brooms that come alive?
I mean, Elton John was, as we all know, a sorcerer's apprentice. No, just this sort of like, you know.
Bernie Taupin was a sorcerer.
Right. That we can do concert sequences and stuff that have fantastic elements. Like, he can like rise off the stage, right? That you can... rather than the Bohemian Rhapsody idea, which is like, let's really try and mimic Live Aid, like beat for beat, sort of movement for movement. Let's sort of have it running as we're filming it to like just replicate it as much as possible. Like, have fun with it. You know, go crazy. Elton John was such a showman, especially back then. He was so much about the sort of fantasy element. I don't know. I like that idea.
I just want to once again say for the record, I have never not been on board for Rocket Man, and history will remember me fondly when this movie is great. Also, in other great, genius bit of promotion, Richard Madden and Taron Egerton did an episode of Carpool Karaoke, which I was able to watch without any kind of like subscription. I've been off Carpool Karaoke for like a really long time because it's like there's only so much Carpool Karaoke you can stand. But Richard Madden, Taron Egerton driving around London doing antics and singing Elton John songs for about 12 minutes was some of the best time I've ever spent on these here internets. So get with it. Richard Madden, not a great singer, is aware of that, is like very intimidated to be sitting next to Taron Egerton, who is a fantastic singer. And it's just great, great accented fun. But like, what a great use of Carpool Karaoke to showcase an actor that they're really, really trying to push. Taron is actually singing. No, really, Taron is actually singing. No, please pay attention. Taron can sing.
Yeah, and you know, in terms of Richard Madden, James Bond doesn't have to sing, so he'll be fine.
Right.
Because I'm assuming he'll be cast as James Bond. But the one thing that's kind of, I think, dampening this fun and my anticipation for the movie is these reports that Paramount has been in a fight with the producers about cutting one bare butt, you know, two men in bed kind of thing. And it's like, good Lord, like, really? You know, it's Elton fucking John.
Yeah,
like, what do we think he was doing, you know? Yeah.
Although, maybe this is me being too cynical from Oscar season. Like, it just makes me wonder if, like, that got out there just so they could be like, no, it's in there. So when there's, like, 2 minutes of, like, gay stuff in it, we're like, well, they saved it from being totally
straight-washed. Right.
Katie, you're probably right.
The sourcing on that, the initial sourcing on that was like a little funky. Though I definitely retweeted about it and I was like, how dare they? While acknowledging like that the sourcing, I was like, what is this? Where is this coming from exactly? We should say though that like another story this week is that China cut out 2 minutes of LGBT content from Bohemian Rhapsody. And
they had to do.
Right.
Exactly. Yeah. I think one of our colleagues out there, wrote up a thing, was like, maybe it shouldn't be that easy to cut the LGBT content out of a Freddie Mercury biopic. What do you think? And so my hope for Elton John, I mean, like, you know, to that end, Richard Madden, in that Carpool Karaoke episode, Richard Madden and Taron Egerton talk about how much they had to kiss. And they didn't say had to. They were just joking about they were joking about all the stubble rash that they got from kissing each other on this project. So I don't think it's just that bare bottom scene that they're
talking
about.
Stubble rash, that's going to sell a movie.
I'm Bobby Finger.
And I'm Lindsay Weber.
Do you ever see a new face or name on your news feeds and say, who the heck is that?
Our podcast, Who Weekly, is everything you need to know about the celebrities you don't. Think of us as your cheat code to People Magazine, your glossary for Hollywood, a shortcut to understanding pop culture at large.
For the past 8 years, Who Weekly has been telling listeners everything they need to know about the celebrities they don't. The New Yorker says we spelunk deep into the demimonde with convivial delight. That's a direct quote.
Mostly, we're going to explain to you Irish star Barry Keoghan's sudden rise to fame and relationship with a not-so-under-the-radar pop princess named Sabrina.
The fake wedding Real Housewives star Cynthia Bailey had to promote a limo rental company.
And why all the Gen Zers you know are talking about a guy named Benson Boone.
Each episode goes deep into the biggest celebrity stories of the moment. And if you're still confused, we even have a weekly call-in episode where we answer the most burning celebrity queries.
Who Weekly airs twice weekly with brand new episodes on Tuesdays and Fridays. Listen and follow Who Weekly, an Odyssey podcast, available now for free on the Odyssey app and wherever you get your podcasts.
Okay, so we have gathered David here, not just for all of his excellent movie opinions, but because there's a new Tim Burton movie out this week. It is, of all things, Dumbo. And it is continuing Tim Burton's recent trend of just remaking other people's intellectual property. But people seem to like this Dumbo a little better. David, since you've been in the Tim Burton mines for months, let us know how Dumbo
Well, I should say, just before you answer, David, David is wearing a top hat and a little red waistcoat.
And I have clown makeup on.
Yeah, yeah.
The biggest achievement of this movie is that Tim Burton slaps clown makeup all over Colin Farrell, and somehow Colin Farrell's more attractive. Like, I don't even know how that works, but it somehow you're like, should Colin Farrell like play the Joker? Like, is that what I want to happen now? I liked Dumbo. I don't know if the reaction I was getting coming out of the screening was mixed, right? Some people were sort of like, it's fine, he's an elephant. There's a little bit of positivity. There were definitely some people who were not very interested in the exploits of Dumbo, the flying elephant. But Burton has literally already done this. He did Alice in Wonderland in 2010. It's the worst film ever made, in my opinion, basically, right? I don't know if you guys agree.
It's barely a film.
It's barely a film. It's really...
Hard agree.
Right.
Hard
it's
agree.
It's more of a, you know, I don't know, it's like water torture, that thing. And so we've sort of, like, it's... There's literally nothing you would think that Tim Burton, who has become a fairly artistically bankrupt person anyway, could get out of remaking a 65-minute cartoon about a flying elephant that has the racist crows, so you got to lift them out too. So it's probably like a 55-minute cartoon, right? You're working with next to nothing. But I don't know. I like Dumbo. He's a little misfit. He's a little Tim Burton guy. Like, he's got big ears and everyone laughs at him, but he's better than any of them, and he flies around the circus. And then every human actor in it is just dialed to like 15.
Or
like
zero.
Or zero.
Like, there's no in between.
Who's at zero?
Yes.
Like,
yeah.
Alan Arkin is in several scenes in this wild performance where he has one line. I mean, I don't want to spoil it, but he has one line where you're like, is this about the movie? And Danny DeVito is doing this crazy thing.
I think DeVito's great.
The children
are soulful.
The children in it are like on nothing.
Like the children are bad.
Like they're bad. But like when the movie,
including Tandy Newton's daughter.
Yeah. Yeah.
They're very.
Who looks just like her?
Yeah,
she does. They're very like monotone and sort of like Dumbo's a flying elephant. I don't know. They, you know,
you
the
don't
girl
really
likes STEM.
Yeah. Well, right. Yeah. She's right. Into science.
Right.
But like when the film zeroes in on Dumbo, which is this kind of, you know, interesting CGI creation, then you get some of that old Burton-y, like, oh, it's Edward Scissorhands. It's mm-hmm. like, it's the kind of moon-eyed, you know,
yes.
Dumbo has these big blue eyes and none of the other elephants have blue eyes and the ears are great and sometimes the ears look like hair. Like, it's just like...
Yeah, Dumbo's a little ingenue-ish. Like, you know, the ear
there's
might...
There's a coquettishness
like,
yes, to Dumbo that... and I will say, when he flies, it's kind of glorious. You're like, yes. Oh, wow.
I think it might partly be like this sort of Pavlovian, like, I've watched Dumbo a lot when I was a little child, and I just like it when Dumbo flies. Like, is it that rooted, like, elementally in my, you know, movie-going DNA that I just like it when the elephant flies? But I definitely, like... You know, got a little choked up when the elephant flew.
I think we like it when I think it's Dumbo specific, but it's also a broader thing of it's just almost always satisfying when the discounted, underappreciated, whatever thing,
right.
creature, person reveals this beautiful skill or this beautiful ability, you know, like whatever that is. It's
yes.
just always exciting.
But then what I like about the movie, and I'm sure I'll talk about this more, is like if you remember, the Disney cartoon ends with Dumbo flying. That's it. The happy ending is that Dumbo flies and everything is solved by Dumbo flying.
And he doesn't need the feather.
Right, and his mom is reunited with him.
But what this film presupposes.
Maybe he does.
In this movie, you know, Dumbo flies pretty early and then is basically surrounded with, like, a huge glitzy capitalist machine, you know, spearheaded by Michael Keaton, who's the sort of villain of the movie, to try and, like, all right, let's sell tickets off of Dumbo, right? And I could not. You can only take it as Tim Burton talking about what happened to him. Mm-hmm. That's the only way I could think about it once that all started firing. Like, that Tim Burton's kind of making fun of himself and making fun of the, like, Disney machine he got swallowed up into. And, like, they're like, Planet of the Apes, you want to do that? Sure.
Yeah.
I'll do some apes.
So Dumbo flying is Edward Scissorhands, and then everything that comes next is the rest of Burton's career?
That's how I was taking that movie. And I was sort of, like, amused that he had literally done it within a Disney remake. Maybe if I cornered Tim Burton, he'd be like, what are you talking about? I don't know. You know, who knows? But it was after watching 5 months of Burton movies, like after doing this Burton series where I watched all the good ones and then I watched the sort of middling ones and then I watched the truly putrid ones, it was sort of all I could think about.
Yeah. No, I think that's fair. So zooming out and looking at now Burton in aggregate and that, I you know, that you liked Dumbo. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I liked Dumbo.
And I thought
it's
that
cool elephant.
Miss Peregrine was a kind of improvement on past work that he'd done. Do you think that there is hope for Burton's arc, for his trajectory? Like,
I don't know. I mean, we thought about him as an Oscar person when we were doing this show because his early movies, you know, would win design Oscars. Martin Landau won an Oscar for Ed Wood. But Burton was always, I think, not taken very seriously by the Academy and would never really get the sort of big nominations, even as his movies were so well-liked. You know, he was the comic book guy. He was the weirdo guy, right? And then when Big Fish was coming out, that was the moment when everyone was sort of like, okay, this will be it. This will be his serious movie that crosses over and it gets a bunch of Oscar nominations. And it didn't. Mm-hmm. Right? It didn't do that well, and it only got a Best Score nomination. And I feel like that's the moment in Burton's career where he's like, all right, well, forget it. I'll go make blockbusters for the rest of my life, I guess. Every movie will cost $200 million, right? Mm-hmm. Like, that's... And it's funny to think, you know, he made Sweeney Todd. He's occasionally trended back into more prestige-y territory.
Don't forget about those big eyes.
Those big eyes. They were so big. Mostly I feel like Burton kind of just, he didn't do the Spielberg thing of like, I'm going to keep cracking at this until they acknowledge me. Like, he was just like, forget it. All right. You know.
Yeah.
It's just so hard. It's so hard when your strongest brand is like outcast misfit and then you become like, you know, a billionaire at the center of Hollywood. What can you possibly say? I guess you can talk about this cute little elephant, but, like, you know, what do you genuinely have to say on the subject anymore?
Yeah.
You can be James Gunn and get fired from your big thing and then get rehired. Now he's a misfit again. It really is.
That's a good strategy.
Point, right.
And I think also, you know, I've been listening to the season, David, and I'll be on the Big Eyes episode in a couple
of
weeks.
Yes.
And Big Eyes is actually kind of an exception to this, but, like, something about computers and Tim Burton was just a terrible mix.
Yeah, I think Mars Attacks is the first one that has CGI. And the CGI in Mars Attacks is cool.
It's fun.
But you can, like, then in the arc of his career, you can sort of see, like, him being like, oh, I guess most things can be CGI, right? Like, we can just leave that to the computers. Right. And then you end up with, like, Charlie and the Chocolate Factory and Alice in Wonderland and these, like, soupy backgrounds.
That feel placeless. Right. And, you know, and I think there are parts of Dumbo that I wanted to be beautiful. The film opens with this sort of train journey of this circus train traveling from, you know, South Florida up into the middle of the country. But all the landscapes are sort of fake and the train is fake. And you're like, oh, God. Like, well, and then, like, but toward the end of the film when Dumbo, you know, supposedly moves up in station and is at this bigger circus, it's like all that's very CGI. And I got annoyed at that. But then the actual elephant, it's great.
Yeah, they must they must have spent a ton of money making that elephant.
The way
into
he walks
an
and everything. It's reminded me of not Tim Burton's Planet of the Apes, but the newer ones that's kicked off with the James Franco one, where the expressions on their face that they're able to do through motion capture, or whatever, are incredible. And Dumbo really, like, gives off a lot of emotion. And you just wish that, like, if Burton could focus on that being the sort of visual wizardry that he does with computers, and then everything else could be more practical,
yeah.
then I think you have something that you can really connect to, and maybe you recast the kids and do a couple other things and have Alan Arkin be in every scene.
He should be in every scene of every movie yeah. doing that character and that performance, in my opinion.
Yeah.
Can I ask a kind of obvious question? This seems more different from the original than most of yes. the Disney remakes. Like, we've seen The Lion King, which looks like a shot-for-shot remake. Right. Aladdin's not coming far.
It's not doing the Jungle Book, Beauty and the Beast thing, where it's like, let's just do the movie again. Right.
Yeah. So, like, did they have to just do it because the original Dumbo is, like, 75 minutes long and they had to add stuff?
65 minutes long. That's how long it is.
Wow. God bless a short movie. Yes.
Plus the crows, you know?
Yeah, right. Yeah. Plus take out about 5 minutes. Yeah.
What if we replace the crows with Eva Green on a trapeze? Are you in? I'm in.
That's literally just in Burton's rider, I think, you know?
Does this give us any hope, though, that, like, Disney remakes can be something other than a copy, or is this going to be an exception?
I think when you're remaking a more recent beloved movie, you're not allowed to do that, right? Like, that's the Lion King rule. It's like, yeah. this better be the Lion King. People grew up with the Lion King. Dumbo is an 80-year-old movie, so you can mess with it more. It is also very short. The funny thing about Dumbo is, like, it was made because Fantasia was too expensive and they didn't have any money, like, which is funny to think that Disney once was, like, hard up for cash and they were like, we gotta, like, really, you know, cut corners on this elephant movie. So that's why it's so, like, simple and sweet and, so this is the opposite thing of, like, you've got this hour-long, simple, sweet movie, and the remake of it is this, you know, it's, what is it, an hour 50? Like, you know, almost
yeah.
2 hour.
Yeah.
Much more bloated, weird, epic. But it's weird and interesting, at least, instead of just being a shot-for-shot remake. So it sort of has that going for it.
Well, it was nice watching it and not knowing where it was going.
Right,
I mean, totally. You kind of know where it's going.
Well,
but,
I mean,
like,
you know,
because
you don't
we've seen this before.
Gonna,
like,
get sent to the glue factory. Right, I mean, it's still right. a children's movie.
That scene's horrifying. But so I appreciated that, but I don't actually love what.
Right,
what
I'm,
the new
I think
thing
I'm a
is.
Little higher on this than you are, Richard.
Yeah, I mean, I was bored, and I think another thing, you know, that I went in probably, you know, naively on my part was, like, I guess I didn't quite realize how much of a children's film
sure.
it was going to be, and there are parts that are, like, a little scary, certainly parts that are sad, but, like,
it's less wrenching than the cartoon Dumbo.
Yes, it definitely is. It's a softer sort of sell. I think it's just I would say it's almost like a little pandering, and I don't respond to that at all. I have a hard enough time getting into children's films, you know, without that added thing. But so you think if people are going to see it who are listening, like, just go in knowing that, like, this is a movie for little kids, mm-hmm. and I think for a little kid, there was a kid sitting in front of us who I think was pretty into it.
Yeah, he was.
He was bouncing up and down.
At one point, he
talking.
Pointed it at Eva Green and he said, "That's his girlfriend," which was an interesting thing to
and
say.
And the whole audience laughed.
The at elephant's voice. Girlfriend?
I don't know. He didn't specify.
Colin Farrell's?
Tim Burton's?
Yeah, yeah. Who knows?
Here's a true fact about me in this year of our Lord 2019. I will watch any Colin Farrell movie.
Well, I mean, me too.
I think you 100%. And David have that in common.
Yes. And Colin Farrell is giving full, like, sad eye Colin Farrell here. Like, he's a, you know, a cowboy from Kentucky who lost his arm in the war. Like, it's all soulfulness from Farrell.
The only time I was ever on the Blank Check podcast so far has been the Minority Report episode where
right.
David and I just talked about how handsome Colin Farrell was for about 20 minutes.
Yeah,
so
right. That's
there
the
we go.
Start of his Hollywood career. Yeah.
Well, that about wraps up this week's episode of Little Gold Men. David, thank you so much for joining. As this airs, there's like. It's like 18 more Tim Burton movies in your series, something like that.
I don't know. We're almost near the end, aren't we? Didn't we just post Alice in Wonderland? I think we're close. We're closing in on the end of
Sweeney
Burton.
Todd just went up.
Sweeney.
Yeah. With Michael Cerveris, which is great.
Yes,
what a get.
It was
so
actually
cool.
fun to talk to Cerveris about it and hear him try to be charitable towards Deb's performance while also, obviously, you know, having some issues.
Well, also being like, I played the cello with Johnny Depp.
right.
Yeah, he has a great story about meeting Depp. And
yes.
Yeah. So that's
while he was doing Sweeney.
Yeah.
Sweeney.
So it's good for a theater nerd, but also the whole podcast is good for movie nerds. So
sure. We try to mix it up with these, you know, with the guests and stuff. Yeah.
Yeah, obviously everyone should be subscribing to
sure,
Blank Check
sure,
if you're
sure.
listening
yes.
to this. But you can also find all of us at VanityFair.com. I'm back from maternity leave now, so you might see my work now. Welcome back to me. You can find us on Twitter at Little Gold Men and on our own. I'm at Katie Rich. Joanna?
Joe wrote this.
And Richard?
At Dumbo Movie.
And David?
I'm David L. Sims.
This episode was edited and produced by Brett Fuchs, and this week's award for the most succinct review of the year goes to David Sims.
It's fine. He's an elephant.
I'm Rachel Martin. You probably know how interview podcasts with famous people usually go. There's a host, a guest, and a light Q&A. But on Wildcard, we have ripped up the typical script. It's a new podcast from NPR where I invite actors, artists, and comedians to play a game using a special deck of cards to talk about some of life's biggest questions. Listen to Wildcard wherever you get your podcasts, only from NPR. From PR.